Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Dome of the Rock is a shrine found in the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex on Temple Mount in Jerusalem. We are once again returning to Jerusalem, just as we did for episodes 8 and 10 of the Monument series, to talk about the Western Wall and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, get across them. Those episodes dealt with places of enormous religious significance for Jews and Christians, respectively, but this week we're talking about a place of enormous religious significance for Muslims. And the Dome of the Rock really is enormously significant in Islamic history and culture. It is the oldest surviving example of Islamic architecture, for one, and what a spectacular example it is, too, with its famous golden dome. You may already have an idea of what the Dome of the Rock looks like. It's a magnificent building, although it didn't always look like that, as we're going to talk about. But to start its history, we go back a long, long way here to remind ourselves of the history of the location on which it's built, Temple Mount. Before the Dome of the Rock was built in the late 7th century CE, Temple Mount was more or less in ruins. It hadn't been looked after particularly well for the last few hundred years. You may remember from previous episodes how the Jewish First and Second Temples, or Solomon's Temple and Herod's Temple respectively, they stood atop Temple Mount, but both were destroyed. And after the first Jewish-Roman War and then the Bar Kokhba Revolt, Temple Mount was essentially just left in ruins by the Roman custodians of Jerusalem. They under the Roman Emperor Hadrian, they did build a temple to Jupiter there, but then that fell into disrepair too as Christianity overtook the traditional Roman religion. And then in the mid-4th century, there were some efforts that were made to restore the old Jewish temple, but nothing much came of this. And so again, as I say, Temple Mount was left largely forgotten about in terms of development. But everything changed when the Rashidun Caliphate attacked in the year 683. The invading Muslims conquered the city from the Christian Byzantines, and in the time that followed, they decided that they needed to build a mosque, and the location chosen for this place of worship was on Temple Mount, and specifically above a certain rock, hence Dome of the Rock. But before we start talking about the dome, let's talk about the rock, because it's quite a special rock, as it happens. It's known as the Foundation Stone, or the Pierced Stone, or the Noble Rock. And this rock is, it won't surprise you to learn, of significant religious importance in both the Jewish and Islamic faiths, and also to a lesser extent in the Christian faith. The rock is big, it's bloody big. I couldn't find exact dimensions for it, but I'd guess that it's maybe 10 or 15 meters across. It's flat. It's roughly the shape of a quarter circle, and it's pretty busted up on top. There are chunks that are missing, bits have been hewed off, there are holes in it. According to Jewish mythology, right, this rock is where the creation of the world began, and it is also apparently the exact spot where the Holy of Holies, the most sacred part of Solomon's temple, was located, according to some sources. The Holy of Holies, as we talked about in a previous episode, is, again, according to Jewish mythology, where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, inside of which you could find the Ten Commandments that were given to Moses. And it's also believed by Jews to be the place where Abraham was going to sacrifice his son Isaac. So this place, this rock, it crops up a fair bit in the Old Testament. So super sacred, super important, this rock. Quite aside from, you know, the idea that it's where the world began, even though geologically speaking, the rock is actually quite young. It's only 90 million years old, which in geological terms is a spring chicken. It is a sweet summer child. What's that? You want to know in the world where in the world you can find the actual oldest rocks? Well, seeing as you asked, mate, I guess I can tell you that you'll find them, in fact, in Australia, mate, over in WA. They've got rocks over there that are 4.4 billion years old, and also Not much else, to be honest. But anyway, this rock, the foundation stone, it is, it's above a little cavern, which initially was naturally formed, but it's been expanded by humans. It's known as the Well of Souls. And it is an equally significant location. It's important to both Judaism and Islam, and again, to a lesser extent, Christianity. But Jews and Muslims, they both consider the rock and the cavern below it to be the center of the world. And the cavern, in particular, the Well of Souls, is where, according to them, the souls of the dead hang out and wait for the day of judgment. So this foundation stone, it has special significance in both religions, but Muslims also believe that it was from here, from the foundation stone, or the noble rock, as they more commonly call it, that their prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven to... Now, look, this is not a gag, right? This is hadith, mate. This is what Muslims believe. Muhammad ascended to heaven to renegotiate with Allah how many times Muslims had to pray per day. Initially, the big man upstairs had the number at 50. But, mate, come on. You're not getting anything done if you're praying 50 times a day. That's once every half an hour. But Muhammad, he's a shrewd negotiator, it seems, because he got it down to the much more reasonable 5 times a day. 90% off, just like that. The art of the deal. Anyway, point is, this big rock, it's very significant in the Islamic faith, and so it was decided that this new temple in Jerusalem would be built right on top of it. And that was what resulted in the construction of this shrine, the Dome of the Rock. And so in the 680s, not exactly sure when, could have been 685, 686, 688, there are differing sources, work began on building an octagonal shrine covering the rock with a dome on top of the shrine. So if you go and have a look at the shape of this structure, you'll see the octagon outside of it, as sort of bordering this great big dome that's in the middle of the octagon. And the rock that we've been talking about, this great big flat rock that's on the ground there, that is located centrally under the dome. And there's a flight of stairs that go under the rock down to the Well of Souls. Again, all located under today what is a magnificent golden dome, but wasn't golden when it was first built. It was actually made of wood when it was first built. But we'll come to the development and the refurbishment and the renovation of this shrine in due course. But this is the reason that the Dome of the Rock is called the Dome of the Rock, because this dome that was built sits right on top of the foundation stone, the noble rock, a place, again, of huge religious significance to not just Islam, but also to Judaism. But interestingly, right, as this building was being constructed, the building took its architectural cues from some of the Byzantine-style buildings that still stood in Jerusalem, while the dome itself was modelled after the one in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. These two domes, right, the one in the church and the one in the dome, the dome in the dome, sure, they both have almost exactly the same dimensions. And you might think, well, okay, why? Well, isn't this an example of, you know, ancient or at least very early medieval Islamic architecture? Why is it all of a sudden now Byzantine and Christian in its design? Well, it is certainly an example of Islamic architecture and a splendid example of Islamic cultural output. But the reason that the building takes some of these cues from other cultures, other religions, is because, it's thought at least, that much of the work carried out on the Dome of the Rock was done by Christians. So they were just building what they knew. And I'll tell you this, an absolutely enormous amount of money was poured into the construction of the Dome of the Rock. They wanted to make this shrine as magnificent and as impressive as possible. And they certainly succeeded, as you can see with the way it is these days. Although it has, as I say, it's been renovated, it's been refurbished, it's been updated. But from go to woe, this place has been a lavish and an opulent piece of architecture. It's thought that the Umayyad Caliph Abd al-Malik, the bloke who ordered its construction, was hoping to establish the Dome of the Rock and Jerusalem more broadly as a rival to the Islamic holy city of Mecca. He didn't like the bloke in charge of Mecca, a rival caliph by the name of Abd Allah ibn al-Zubayr. These two actually went to war against each other here and there. And so he was trying to establish Jerusalem as a rival holy city to undermine Mecca. But whatever the reason the Dome of the Rock was built, by 692, this magnificent shrine was finally completed, and soon the area around it developed into a larger religious complex, the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. Other buildings, such as a large prayer hall, sprang up, and the area quickly became a a place of central religious importance to Muslims throughout the Islamic world. The Umayyads took very good care of the place too after it was constructed. It remained lavishly decorated, a place of great grandeur, but I will say in time that did change. In 808 and then again in 846, earthquakes hit Jerusalem and damaged the Dome of the Rock. And unfortunately, by this stage, the ruling Abbasid Caliphate was a lot less interested in Jerusalem in general compared to the Umayyads. And so the Al-Aqsa Mosque in general suffered a bit of neglect at their hands. But it only got worse from there, because in 1015, another earthquake hit and the Dome of the Rock instead became the open-air ruin of the rock when the dome itself collapsed. Now, it was repaired a couple of years later, and then it was reinforced once another earthquake hit in 1033. But broadly speaking, these earthquakes saw the Dome of the Rock and the surrounding Al-Aqsa Mosque rebuilt without the same splendor and magnificence as before. Again, the Abbasids and then later the Fatimids, they just weren't as interested in Jerusalem as the Umayyads had been and didn't promote it as an Islamic holy city in the same way that the Umayyads had sought to. However, it wasn't just earthquakes that the Dome of the Rock had to be defended from. In the late 11th century, Christian crusaders turned up, and so the ruling Fatimid Caliphate had to defend their holy site from these invaders. They did not, however. Jerusalem fell to the crusaders, and remember how I said before that the foundation stone isn't in good nick, how bits had been, you know, chipped and hewed off it? The crusaders have a lot to do with that, because a lot of them chipped off little bits of it as they went to visit the foundation stone and the Well of Souls beneath it, presumably as souvenirs, although that's just a guess. I actually couldn't find exactly why they damaged it as badly as they did. In any case, the crusaders, after capturing Jerusalem, they converted Al-Aqsa Mosque into a Christian religious complex. They whacked a cross on top of the Dome of the Rock, and they renamed it as the Templum Domini, the Temple of God. And interestingly, right, this is where the Knights Templar get their name. They get their name from the Temple of Solomon, with their headquarters in Al-Aqsa Mosque. They seemed to quite like the Dome of the Rock and the way that it looked, and they used it as an architectural blueprint for the classic round Templar churches that they went on to build all across Europe. Anyway, before too much longer, old mate Saladin came along, episode 201, get across it. He reconquered Jerusalem for Islam in 1187. He ripped down the cross off the top of the dome, bunged a crescent moon back on top of it, and generally undid a lot of the renovations that the Christians had done over the last 100 years. Oh, I shouldn't say that. He didn't undo the renovations. He didn't tear down the buildings that the Christians had built or rip down the decorations they'd put up. He just reconverted the entire complex back to a Muslim one. And he did a lot more than that, too. He and the leaders after him restored the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque to their former glory, with a lot of money being spent to decorate and to smarten up the place after the centuries of, neglect, you could say, under both the Abbasids and the Fatimids. Under the authority of the Mamluks, the Dome of the Rock did very, very well for itself, although it was still lacking its golden roof, I have to say that. We'll come to that in a little bit, don't you worry. And it only got better from there when the Ottomans rocked up and took over Jerusalem in 1516. The Ottomans also worked to develop and expand the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, and the Dome of the Rock specifically, under the rule of Suleiman the Magnificent, husband of Hürrem Sultan, episode 257, get across it. The shrine's exterior was freshly and beautifully tiled, while successive Ottoman governors in Jerusalem continued to expand the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex more broadly. The Ottomans really did look after the Dome of the Rock pretty well, I would say, initially to begin with, although it did become a little bit run down by the end of the 18th century, and so extensive renovations and restorations were undertaken by the Ottomans throughout the 19th century, and the place was as splendid as ever as we arrive to the 20th century. When, of course, the British, who controlled Jerusalem after the First World War, became the custodians of the Dome of the Rock. They oversaw repairs after an earthquake in 1927. And then, in time, the Jordanian government would step in the late 1950s to renovate the shrine once more. And it was during these renovations in the late 1950s that the Dome of the Rock finally received what is probably its most iconic and famous attribute, its Golden Dome. Before the renovations in the late 1950s, the dome had been made of lead. Super safe. Don't even worry about it. Maybe whack some asbestos up in there as well, just to make sure it doesn't burn down. But then in 1959, the lead was removed and it was replaced with an alloy of aluminium and bronze, which was then coated with gold leaf. Now, this, of course, was a very expensive enterprise, but it only gets more expensive from there because in 1993, the gold on the dome had to be redone, which was financed by the Jordanian king, Hussein bin Talal. And he really put himself out to do this. Let me tell you, he paid for 80 kilograms of gold. He pulled together over $8 million to fund the refurbishment efforts of the Dome of the Rock. And he did this by selling a single one of the houses that he owns in London. So, I don't know. Good on you, Hussein, mate, I guess, for looking after the Dome of the Rock. But maybe, I don't know, maybe you could have just used some of the money that the CIA had paid you for all those years and years. Don't know what happened to those particular funds, do we, Hussein, old son? Anyway, these renovations, they left the Dome of the Rock looking more or less as it does today. A magnificent and lavish example of early Islamic architecture, richly decorated with not just its golden dome, but its tiled walls and everything else about the building. You should go online and have a look at pictures of the, particularly the interior of the Dome of the Rock, because it really is spectacular. However, if you want to visit the Dome of the Rock in person, this is not going to be such a simple thing. And these days, while it is possible, oh boy, years and years ago, it would have been even more tricky to get inside the Dome of the Rock, because all the way up until 1967, right, there were very, very stringent restrictions on who could access Temple Mount. Virtually all non-Muslims were completely forbidden from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, entering Temple Mount. There were exceptions made. There are some famous stories of some wealthy Jewish visitors to Jerusalem who wanted to visit Temple Mount. And so special exceptions were made for them by the governing Ottomans to allow them inside the site. But these visiting Jews had to be carried into Temple Mount, had to be carried aloft by a team of Muslims for a reason which I will explain in due course. But famous historical figures like Baron Rothschild were borne aloft by Muslims carrying him below, so he wouldn't violate, as we'll talk about, he wouldn't violate the law of the Torah. Anyway, we'll come to that. Let's talk about some of the restrictions that were and still are in place when it comes to accessing Temple Mount and the Dome of the Rock. From 1967 onwards, after the Six-Day War, you became able to visit Temple Mount regardless of your faith. Before that, if you weren't a Muslim, you were essentially just out of luck. You couldn't visit the Dome of the Rock. You couldn't really get into the Al-Aqsa complex at all, again, unless a special exception was made for you. But these days, things are a little more open. If you're a Muslim, you can get in no worries most of the time. There are plenty of gates that you can use to access Temple Mount. You can go in and, you know, pray or chill or whatever. Most of the time. Anyway, sometimes there have been restrictions put in place on men under a certain age entering the complex due to various security fears. But anyway, broadly speaking, if you're a Muslim and you want to visit Temple Mount, that's fine. Broadly speaking, shouldn't be too much of an issue most of the time. But if you're not a Muslim, things are a little bit trickier. There's only one single gate you're allowed to use, the Mughrabi Gate. This is the only way that you can access Temple Mount if you're not a Muslim. And you're only allowed in at certain times and for only very limited durations. And unless you're a Muslim, you're also not allowed to pray while on Temple Mount. You'll actually get asked to leave. Only Muslims are allowed to pray in Al-Aqsa and on top of Temple Mount. And then there are more restrictions placed on Jews who may want to visit Temple Mount, because if you're a Jew, you're not, according to Jewish religious law anyway, you're not allowed to enter Temple Mount at all. Jewish rabbis have warned Jews that the Torah forbids them from entering Temple Mount and setting foot on one of the most holy and sacred sites in Judaism. One reason I read for this is because after the destruction of the Second Temple, it's actually impossible to be exactly sure where things like the Holy of Holies are. And So someone just, you know, wandering through the site might inadvertently set foot on sacred ground. And this was the reason that Jewish visitors like Baron Rothschild had to be carried by Muslims when entering Temple Mount so they wouldn't inadvertently break Jewish law. Now, when I say law here, I'm talking about religious law. It's not actual law. Some Jews still enter Temple Mount anyway, but there are police guarding the entrances to Temple Mount, ensuring that the entry restrictions are upheld, and many Jewish people choose not to enter Temple Mount because even though it's thought that the Holy of Holies was located on top of the foundation stone, it's not by any means certain. And so I guess better safe than sorry, they don't want to break religious law and set foot on sacred ground. So many Jews choose to stay off the top of Temple Mount and instead visit the Western Wall, as we've already talked about. But debate rages on to this very day about whether the restrictions placed on people, both legal and religious, about the visiting of Temple Mount and places like Dome of the Rock. Debate rages on as to whether these restrictions uphold or undermine the concept of the status quo, which, again, we talked about in a previous episode, episode 10, Get Across It. But with Jerusalem being a holy city for three different major religions, there are a lot of very complicated issues when it comes to the custodianship of a place like Temple Mount. But with Jerusalem being a holy city for three very different major religions, there are a lot of very complicated issues when it comes to the custodianship of a place like Temple Mount. Anyway, that is the story of the Dome of the Rock, one of the most famous landmarks in Jerusalem and one of the most important places in Islamic faith and culture. And with this episode, we have now rounded out our exploration of the three major holy sites for the three major religions invested in Jerusalem.